What's up, guys? This is Tony Angus. Welcome to Chat Time, where I have a conversation with interesting people about the world we live in and the things that matter to us most. Join me each week for a sometimes fun, sometimes controversial, sometimes enlightening, but always enjoyable chat. Today I'll be chatting with Shelley Flett. Shelley's an expert in leadership development and team performance. She has successfully operated her consulting practice since 2015, after more than 13 years working as a leader herself in various roles across customer service and operations. Shelley has authored two books, The Direction Dilemma, Why Knowing What You Want Makes You a Better Leader, and The Dynamic Leader, Becoming the Leader Others Are Inspired to Follow. I think you'll get a lot out of what Shelley has to say about leadership, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Okay, folks, well, I'm here with Shelley Flett. Shelley is an expert in leadership, team development, and thanks for joining me on the podcast, Shelley.
Thanks for having me, Tony. I'm really excited to be chatting with you today.
Congratulations on your book. I'm going to give the plug really early, so folks, go out and buy that thing. So The Dynamic Leader, I really enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. And, you know, I was so pleased that a lot of it matched my own understanding. So I went, I'm not that far off the track. But there were some really nice little innovations that you pulled in there. And so if you're cool with it, let's just talk about the book.
Absolutely. And
Before we do, maybe we'll just talk about your journey to this point. You're obviously a consultant and a mentor and a trainer. How did you come to be in this role?
That's really interesting. I never, ever saw myself as being the person that would be coaching other people, but I started being the person who was coached. And so I think when you get exposed to a coach and an environment, I guess this is probably similar for people who've had coaches in sport, is imagine trying to play a sport without a coach after you've already had one. And so I had a coach, and then I got another coach and another coach, and then I had some, I guess, moments of realization. There were a lot of light bulbs going off through all of the coaching. So I had some great coaches. I just got to the stage where I realized there was more to life than the corporate bubble was able to offer me. And I felt like I had gone... I felt like I'd gone around the cycle a few too many times. I felt like in my corporate career that I was doing things that I'd already done before. And so it had lost a little bit of its spark. And I thought, well, I could go to another corporate organization or I could do something else. But I kind of felt like it was limiting for what I thought I was capable of doing and offering the world. And so probably more of a global kind of thinker and going, well, how can I make a difference? And where can I make the most impactful difference is how I led, how I got to leadership. Because I got it really wrong. I got it super wrong in the beginning. And it took a long time to get it right. And I thought, you know, if I can make a difference to one leader, and you know that one leader has a more pleasant journey or comes out the other end with more confidence or more understanding of their abilities, then that's for me is success. So that's how I got to where I am now, essentially.
One of the things that you say in the book that I really resonated very, very strongly with is that the idea that people become a leader, put into leadership roles, but unlike when they enter an organization, they're giving this wonderful induction period and they're given coaching and mentoring and they're, you know, their hand is held as they are wandered through the position and this is how we want you to do this. And then they become a team leader or a manager or whatever. And all of that process suddenly stops and you're on your own. You're supposed to just intuit supposed to be done.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that much different to, you know, just letting a toddler look after themselves after they've learned to walk. It doesn't make any sense. But, you know, in saying that, I do have a great respect for the difficulty in doing that. you know, leaders are not, there's not intakes of leaders in organizations constantly. So it becomes really hard to have something that's set up and works for everyone and is still cost effective. So, you know, I say it doesn't work the way that it is, but I don't know what the alternative is that, you know, every organization sends their leader to my dynamic leader's tutelage when I'm running it. And then I take care of that part.
And they buy the book.
Yeah, and buy the book. And I mean, that's essentially why the program is running and why the book is there is don't you worry about trying to come up with your training. I've got the training that any new leader needs. I run my programs publicly, so they're with other leaders of other organizations. And it's really good because they can start to talk about the challenges that they're having and find that the challenges are not unique to an organization or an industry. They're unique to people. They're all about people. And so it's really good just to have that conversation and also share their hesitations or fears or worries that you might have and know that there's other people out there who are feeling exactly the same thing. So it's quite good.
Yeah, I really like that thinking. So did you have that sort of experience when you got into leadership at first where you were put into positions where you were almost set up to fail?
Look, I don't think I was set up to fail. I think that this is what I think we've got to trust is that when someone trusts us to move into a leadership role, for the most part, they've made the right decision. You know, I applied for a leadership position a couple of times and I didn't get it. And I think it was because they didn't want to set me up for failure. They didn't want to put me in a position that would, you know, cause me that I wasn't ready for. And so they saw that I was ready for it. I just didn't have the knowledge. I didn't have a toolkit. I didn't have any kind of guide that I could refer to find things out. It was very much, stumbling in the dark.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that sometimes people are put in leadership because they have tremendous product knowledge or they are, you know, they're great at what they do. And so they go, well, let's put them in charge. But of course, leadership and mentoring and managing is nothing to do with that, really. And one of my favorite quotes ever was Henry Ford, who said, I don't need to know everything about car manufacturing. I just need to know how to hire the people who do. And I really like that. You don't need to be an expert. You just need to be able to manage the people who are experts in their little fields of endeavor. So, you know, regardless of the industry you're in, your job becomes less of a product job and more of a people job. And that's where possibly a senior management look at potential managers and go, I'm not sure if you can do that because you've got great product knowledge, you've got a tremendous experience, but we really want somebody who's more experienced with people.
Yeah. One of the concepts that I've been playing around with a little bit recently is leaders who build dependency over leaders who build capability. And I think that when we step into a leadership role, we can automatically gravitate to building dependency. Part of that is ego-driven, self-serving. If I'm needed, then I'm doing the right thing, or I've validated my position, or that I feel more secure. But what we're doing is actually putting ourselves into a bit of a dead end. What we need to be doing is building capability. So how you build capability it's complex. It's not straightforward.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And, you know, a lot of leaders want to be revered, whereas I think what's true is that, and I had this conversation with another of my guests, and we were talking about the fact that it's not as if, say, you're in charge of a team and I'm senior management and the team's doing really well. It's not as if I go, but what's Shelley doing? I'm assuming that the team is running really well because of their manager, even though you may not be pushing yourself to the fore and announcing yourself as this guru and really asking everybody to sort of throw plaudits your way, you know, senior management get it. You're a good manager because the team is functioning really well.
Which is the challenge that we have, because if when you're an individual contributor, it is all about that kind of thing. And so you move from an individual contributor into a leadership position. It's that, like I call it that first level of leadership is really the apprenticeship. It's where you need to be able to communicate with individual contributors and understand how the work is done and understand the effort that goes into it and understand the need to be seen to be busy and to be seen to be delivering something other than just the, you know, inverted commas, warm and fluffy conversations. But you've also then got a leadership level above you who is looking at you for how are you building capability? How are you actually growing your team and how are they performing without you having to do too much? It's tough.
It is tough. But you know, what's interesting is when you do build that capability, that capacity building, and you offer the members of the team some autonomy, then they appreciate you so much more. You'll here take some responsibility. And I know you're going to trip and you're going to fall at times, but know that I recognize it's part of a learning process, part of a growth process, and you'll only get better at it. So I give you permission to try, and I give you permission to fail. I also give you permission to succeed gloriously, but you have some autonomy over the way you're doing that and some capacity to run your own show as well under my leadership. And I think we misrepresent that. And I love what you're saying about that level one being an apprentice and moving away from that individual focus. I've got my tasks to perform, to have a look and an overarching look at all of the individual tasks being performed as a group.
Mm. Yeah, it's a process, and I think you need to have people around you. Like if I think about, you know, what differentiates someone who succeeds versus someone who fails, I think is having a really good support network. So having people around you who can give you unbiased, you know, really neutral but compassionate feedback, and feedback that helps you to succeed, and that we don't try to go it alone. Because I think the other thing we try to do at that initial level of leadership is be a bit of a lone wolf, and we don't need to.
Yeah, they're still part of, they're a cog in the machine too, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. And not everyone's trying to steal your job.
No, that's so true. The people do get in there and they become very protective of their position suddenly, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's like, gosh, what happens? Like, what are you doing? What's the ulterior motive? Are you trying to steal my job? Are you trying to get me fired? Are you trying, you know, it's the self-talk that can come in. And I'm guilty of that myself. Is I'm highly competitive, and I've learned over the last couple of years to stop comparing myself to other people and just compare myself to me. And so I've retained that competitive side by comparing myself to me, which, you know, fulfills that drive, but I don't compare to other people because I have no idea what's going on for them, and it's never what I think it is. And I remember when I was in the corporate environment, I was competing against this woman who, you know, I saw her as a bit of a threat. She was outgoing and she was capable, and you know, she'd get tapped on the shoulder for a lot of opportunities, and I really felt like I was competing against her. What's interesting is she moved into a space that has absolutely no similarity to what I'm doing, and she's loving it and thriving. And so I kick myself about, you know, how many hours I spent focusing on something that didn't even exist. Like we weren't even playing the same game yet, let alone competing for the same title. Like I was so far off.
Yeah, I think you're right, and we don't know what journey they're on. We don't know their own drivers, and you don't know, they might be looking at you and thinking, you know, wow, if only I was like them. We don't ever know. And one of the little sort of messages I like to give when I'm teaching is, don't look at people's social media feed when they're, you know, they've got all the makeup on and they're in the nicest places. Here am I on Venice Beach, or here am I in front of the Eiffel Tower, and I'm with the best looking girl here, and I'm done up in looking all GQ, and I've got my, you know, Ray-Bans on, and life is wonderful for me. If only you knew my secrets, forget it. That guy probably goes home and is as insecure as any of us, and struggling to make some money, and life isn't as glorious as it looks on their social media feed. So you're right. The only competition you have is with yourself, and how to be growth oriented personally in your own development.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that openness to be also a little bit vulnerable, because I think the impression that we have of other people can stop us from opening up and asking for help when we need it.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, it's almost as if once you become manager, you're supposed to know everything.
Yeah, I call them superhuman, which don't exist. They're a little bit like Superman. It's just, it's not real.
Yeah, and even, it's funny because even corporate giants have mentors.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, because, you know, a mentor, and so this is the difference between a mentor and a coach, is a mentor is someone who's been there before and they've done it. So CEOs will have other CEOs or ex-CEOs that mentor them. And, you know, that's to help give them ideas around, this is something that I've tried before, maybe you want to try that, or have you considered that, or, you know, keep an eye on this, or whatever. Whereas a coach is someone who may not have ever done what you're doing before, but has the ability to ask you questions and tap into, you know, the blind spots that you have, and help you to reach a different level of potential. And so I think you need both. I have mentors and I have coaches.
I really like that idea. And the coach is quite often a person that goes in with the formulae that help us to succeed, as well as, you know, whether I've been there or not, I know that there are formulas that we can use for success. And you've got that wonderful dynamic leader model that you use. Perhaps if you'd run listeners through what that is about, because I noticed there's some sort of, I think you call one a dysfunctional leaders, and then you've got dynamic leaders. So is that like different levels of leadership? And
yeah, so it's different focuses. So down the bottom end, you're very much responsive and reactive and at the mercy of the things that are happening to you. And I think that we come in at a level that is quite reactive. We start leading, and we're just picking things up as they're being thrown at us. And we've just got to be careful that we don't do that for a long period of time. So fine to do that in the early stages where you're finding your feet, but really needing to move up a few rungs on the ladder, if you will, to start to look at, well, how do I become more proactive? How do I start to use the resources around me? How do I get out of the detail and start to look at things more big picture? Really question the why is the organization, why does the organization exist? Why does my team exist? Why does my role exist? And be able to connect the dots, because I think leaders really need to be able to provide a compelling narrative and bring people along on the journey. So, you know, people need to know, what is it that we're aiming to achieve? What is it they want, that we're moving towards? And so being able to connect the dots, I think. And the higher level on the ladder is, well, you're not going to be here forever. What are some of the things that you can teach your people so that they can step into your role when the time comes? So succession planning, and we don't do much of that. I mean, some people do it really well, others not so well at all. But yeah, being able to look at, well, what's going to happen, who's moving into it, and then how can I start to build their capability and skill set so that when they move in, it's a seamless transition.
Yeah, I love that. And it's so free of ego. And sometimes, so I had a conversation only on, what day is today? Oh, on Tuesday night. And it was with my martial arts students. So I have a karate club. and it's all on Zoom. But we were doing a lot of the theory around what we're supposed to be doing, you know, why these techniques work. And one of the things I said to them was, it's important for me that you understand the theory so that you can replace me. You don't need me. My role in this is to become redundant.
Yeah.
So that my role is to lift you to a point where you go, I don't need that guy anymore. And if I get to that point, I've done my job. And it came as a result of some pretty poor internet connections where I'm trying to run a Zoom call and my internet was kept telling me that I had really low connection and bandwidth was poor. And I had to say to the guys, listen, if I drop out, I know that you'll be able to run it without me because the next level down from me will just take over and go, oh, well, he's gone. Let's continue on. And if he was to drop out, then the next level on would take over as well as they know. And so, yeah, that succession planning and capacity building, again, is designed to make you redundant. But I think managers somehow feel like that redundancy means they're no longer in the organization, whereas quite often it means you get pushed up another rung and you manage the manager who's managing the people. So that's how we actually, like a, what do they call a geyser? We sort of, the water shoots that person up. It's not like we're spitting them out sideways onto the footpath. Quite often we're lifting that everybody up according to how the strength of the capacities of the people they've built under them.
Yeah, and I would say that up is not always the way that you want to go either, and definitely not too quickly. So some of the young leaders that I've coached, you know, my advice, and this is probably more mentoring than coaching, is my advice is don't go too high too quickly, because you end up having this very small platform of which you can operate. And so at the level that I talk about, the entry level of leadership, if you can spend as much time as you can just going from role to role to role at the same level, and just learning, just refining your abilities. Like, this is where the 10,000 hours, you know, when you do 10,000 hours, you can kind of call yourself an expert or whatever it is that that concept, you know, talks about, is leaders need to be able to get as much exposure to the raw, real leadership as they possibly can for as long as they can. And I think so it builds your resilience, it builds your skill set, it really challenges how you think. You know, if you start to, you've got a team that you've, because very different being promoted within a team to taking over a team that you have never worked with as peers. And so I think you need to do that at some point. You need to actually make that sideways transition and work and lead a team and build them up from nothing, from not having any exposure to them.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully put. The thing that I really like there is that you build your own capacity by time in position, and the breadth of your knowledge is become so great that what happens then is your problem solving becomes better. Your ability to handle little issues among the team as they arise becomes better because you did spend time at that first management rung, sussing out different departments, working out different ways of operating. And so you learn to answer new questions and new problems as they arise, rather than relying on that one skill, because that one skill got you to that position. So within that model, is the model designed as a coaching tool to have people recognize where they sit in terms of their own leadership growth?
Yeah, look, it's purely around awareness building. So we don't spend too much time on that. It's just looking at, you know, where are you, where do you resonate? And then also, you know, some people will say, in fact, a lot of leaders will say, well, I'm operating at one level for most times. And then what I find is every couple of months I fall down here. And so that's just about bringing awareness to what are the triggers, what are the conditions, and what can you do to take control of that and reduce the likelihood of dipping. So, yeah, it's really just around awareness.
I think awareness is so important. I often make the comment that if I had a crop duster, I'd like to fly over over the population and just sort of drop a dust on the community that allows people to have greater self-awareness. And because I think that's one of the skills that people really lack is just insight. And so as a manager, having insight, because like you, and I read a couple of your stories and I was like, oh, hello, that rings a bell. I've worked under some pretty good managers. I've worked under some great managers, and I've worked under some managers that were quite woeful. And the contrast becomes one of, I think, a complete misunderstanding of what they were supposed to do. What was management supposed to be about? They quite often get into position because they're a great technician, but then when they get there, they can't manage the people. But they can still do the paperwork really nicely, and upper management can look and go, you know, I don't know what the problem is here, because he's got all his reports on time and seems to be able to manage the department budget, but we're getting all these complaints from staff. Well, you know, there are extra facets to being a manager.
I think the thing with awareness is that you can't increase your self-awareness on your own.
Yeah.
And you need a safe space to be open to building that awareness. So it's a bit of a delicate act, particularly when a lot of us are really terrible at communicating intention. I was running a workshop last night with a group of leaders, and we spoke about Australians and our ability to drop hints incredibly well, but not get to the point. Or when we get to the point, we get there way too quickly and way too directly. So we have this, you know, a little bit of a, either you're not tact, or you lack tact, or, you know, your approach is terrible, or you just, there's way too much ambiguity and I'm actually not really sure what you want. And so we need to be a little bit better at delivering messages, I think, because it's hard. And I spend a lot of time, I've recently developed a feedback model, which might be my third book, actually. It might be the source of a third book. But it really looks at how we deliver feedback and the elements that we often miss, in that feedback is often hidden or laced full of assumptions and mind reads, and how we think someone was feeling when they delivered it, and how we think that made someone else feel, but we don't actually know. We just saw a facial expression, which could have been them being angry. It could have been that they've got an upset tummy. Who knows? But let's kind of work with what we've got. And it's just a mess.
It is a mess. I guess that speaks to human communication across the board, doesn't it? That we can misinterpret. I know in the early days of body language training, and they were talking about, you know, if somebody folds it, well, I fold my arms because there's nothing else to do with them. You know, we don't hang them by our sides as if they're just like little strings of spaghetti just dangling there. They're not sleeves, they're arms. And I don't want to drop them on the table because I don't want to shove the camera around. And I don't have arms on my chair, so what am I supposed to do with my arms? So it's just far more comfortable just to fold them across. Now, in the old days, of course, they'd say, oh, this guy's putting up barriers and things like that. Fortunately, we've become a lot more sophisticated in our understanding of body language. But, you know, the sophistication around the verbal quality, the words we choose, is even more, I think, there are as many dimensions at least as body language within the way we communicate verbally, and of course there's tone of voice, and so many ways that we can misunderstand that according to, because we're functioning under this model that says I have to have a thought, I have to decode that thought into a communication, into a series of selected words from a dictionary that I know half of, and then I have to send it to you accompanied by a series of body language and tonal qualities that are designed to get you to decode that message. using the dictionary you're operating by and your understanding of my tone and body language and come out with the same message. Gee, it's hard.
Yeah, I would say next to impossible. There's always meaning making that goes on. It's just, and so one of the components that I talk about in the feedback model that I use is that it's got to be clean. The feedback's got to be clean. So how you portray and communicate what it is you're giving feedback on is around behavior. And it's only what you have observed. So it's got to be observable and it's got to be objective and it's got to be specific. So no point in me giving you feedback that, you know, you really look angry sometimes. So what are you supposed to do with that?
Yeah, thanks very much. Botox, is it? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, possibly. But, you know, what if you were to go out and get Botox and you completely missed the point?
Yeah, exactly right. So that if the point gets lost to that degree, then the communication's been really bad, hasn't it?
100%. And so, yeah, look, I think that's one of the areas that I'm really working on leaders with a lot now is how do you go out and communicate with people in a way that resonates with them and that you're able to listen, you know, the conversation is not about me, it's about you, the person that I'm talking to. And I think leaders could do with a reminder every now and then that they are operating in service of someone or something else, and that it's not about you at all.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I notice in the book you talk about the difference between using the word I, we, and you, and just those three words thrown into different contexts, they can blow a communication apart.
Yeah. Definitely. You know, I talk about so in a one-on-one conversation that you're having with someone in your team, and particularly a conversation where you're wanting them to take responsibility and commit to something, the worst you can say is, what are we going to do?
Yeah. Terribly ambiguous, isn't it?
Super. Because I'm like, all right, well, I'll leave it with you. You let me know what you got.
Yeah. They do nothing, and then you come back to them and go, well, what have we achieved as a result of our last conversation? And they go, what are you talking about? Have you done any transactional analysis? Have you ever looked at that there's a branch of psychology called TA, transactional analysis? And it's a fascinating study it kind of goes down the dynamic you're talking about. If you're going to write a book, I would recommend it. Because they talk about the communication sometimes between the adult, the parent, the adult, and the child within the two of us, those three dynamics that exist between us, and which one I'm using to communicate to you, and which one you're hearing with and responding with, and sometimes if they're parallel, it's okay. But if they become crossed, it's less okay. And then if there's an ulterior motive to it, I say something and you go, that's not really what you mean, then there's a real problem in that. And the simplest example I've got is, if I come to you and I say, oh, Shelley, what time was that meeting scheduled for the afternoon? So that's just an adult to adult question. Can you tell me the time for the meeting? Now, if you respond as a parent dealing with a child by saying something like, it's okay, I'll look after you, I'll come and tap you on the shoulder when it's time to go, I might find myself going, you know what, I really just wanted you to tell me the time of the meeting. I didn't need you to baby me. So if you just said, oh, it's at 2 o'clock, then good, there's a parallel communication. I ask as an adult, you respond as an adult. But when you respond as a parent talking to a child, it's not what I was wanting. But if I come to you and say, Shelley, I can't work this out. This tech is really confusing me. And you were to say, there's a manual in your cupboard. I've asked you as a child, asking the parent for help. Can I have your help, please? And you've responded as an adult. This is where you'll find the answer. And it becomes very cold and sort of unhelpful. So this crossed communication that they talk about in transactional analysis is actually quite fascinating. And the book, I'm Okay, You're Okay, discusses that at some length. But transactional analysis is obviously, I think, part of what where you're going with that. I look forward to the third book, by the way. I'll be getting that one next.
I'm really excited by it.
I think it sounds great because you're quite right that people don't know how to give feedback. If I'm upset with you for some reason, I've got, and again, in transactional analysis, I can talk to you like a parent. You've been naughty. I can talk to you about a child and say, it hurts my feelings.
Mm.
And I can talk to you as an adult, which is more along the lines of what you're describing. I notice that this is going on. These are the likely consequences of that. And this is what I'd prefer. And so it leads more into that basic assertion that all adults really should understand and be able to carry out.
Yeah. Look, the challenge with it is that it's harder to do that. So in the workshop I ran last night, we were actually role-playing, all right, now give me feedback. And it was just terrible. It was just so unclean. And you know, you go, okay, try again. And then we get probably two or three words in and just go, I just really don't know how to do this. And so we've got a lot of work to do. And these are people who, they're teachers themselves. So, you know, it's fairly easy in, the concept is fairly easy, but the application it's tough. And so, but I'm pretty excited by it.
I think it's wonderful, and I think you'll have most organisations asking you about it in one way or another. You know, I think once that's released, a lot of organisations are going to go, yes, that's what we're not good at. And I find the same thing, that it's okay in theory, but when I stand in front of you and I actually have to call upon those words that I want to use to get across what I want to say, but also because if I was to type it, I would probably be better at it, because then we don't have that. I don't have to look you in the eye. I can deal with my own sweaty palms. I don't have to find that controlled measure of assertiveness and deliver that to you. And I don't have to be fearful of your instant reprisal or that look of hurt in your eyes. You know, that's, people really just hate conflict at the end of the day, which is why we do it so badly. They'll either avoid it completely or they'll go on the attack to put an end to it. And so there's middle ground where we feel like we're in quicksand.
So the way that I teach people to give feedback cannot be taken personally if it's done. So you can't read anything more into it once it's framed right. So you don't have to worry about what the response will be, because you just have to worry about how you're delivering it. And so if you're delivering it right, you know, with current, clean, contextual, and with curiosity, they're the sort of four C's that I use. They can't come back with anything, because you're giving them really objective, observable data that they can't argue with. And so, because this is where the problem is, that we can, we read between the lines and we do go, oh, what's the ulterior motive there? Or what do they mean? Or they're just saying that because they think they're so great, or what, you know, whatever else it is, when there's still those assumptions and the mind reads there, it's really easy to get confused by that. The other thing is, before we start giving feedback, we really need to go out and seek it.
Yeah, be a part of that loop.
Yeah, so, and you know, this is another conversation that I've had recently, is a leader who said, I'm not ready to go and ask my team to give me feedback. And I said, well, that's because you're not being specific enough. So I'm not going to go out to the world and say, hey, I just want you to give me some feedback on me. It kind of opens up who I am as a person to be at the mercy of what anyone thinks. And so when we go out and we seek feedback, we need to be specific around what kind of feedback do we actually want, and for what purpose? So I want your feedback because I want to become an internationally recognized speaker by 2026, true story, that one. And I want to know how I speak. And so I would love your feedback on my verbal communication and my body language that comes with that. Yeah. And so you can then start to see how other people might add to that and actually give you some value. I'm not asking people to talk about whether they like to give me feedback on everything, because they might talk about, you know, they don't like my hair or how I style it or how I wear my makeup, or, you know, things that can be, they can just knock our confidence. And so I think we've got to start somewhere, don't we?
Yeah, 100%. And there's you're talking about a good leader has a measure of vulnerability earlier, but there's a very destructive level of vulnerability, isn't there, where you open your heart up to being destroyed. And we've got to be careful.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. It's like you don't, and when I talk about vulnerability, I'm like, you're not vulnerable with everyone all the time. That's a huge no-no. Like, just don't. But be willing to open yourself up where the situation is right and where it's safe to do so. And I think it's the same with feedback, is for you to go out and seek feedback. The other thing with leaders who go out and seek feedback is I need to just do this as an activity to show my manager that I'm capable of leading. Now, they're not necessarily wanting to hear the feedback. They're just wanting to hear what they want to hear. And a lot of people know that. And so I'm not a fan of 360s or 180 degree feedback. I much prefer, although I do see the purpose of those in the right context, I much prefer develop a culture where you've got really good trust, go out and seek the feedback. When you get the feedback, say thank you. Don't justify it or rebut it or try to add any detail or context, because it is what it is. Say thank you and walk away.
Yeah, it's one of the hardest things it's one of the things I talk about in my courses is if somebody says something to you that's negative, try not to react. Take it on board and just sit with it for a little while and realize that your reaction was probably a fight or flight, that you feel as though in some way you've been threatened, that your life, that your safety has been threatened, and it's triggered this sort of amygdala response. Sit with it for a little while and realize it's not hurting you to get feedback, and start to wonder to yourself which parts that you can immediately take as being true. And once you've done that, it allows you to at least say, okay, I'm opening the box here of their feedback. A snake hasn't popped out, so I'm okay for now. I'm not being bitten on the nose by this by a cobra. So, okay, let's take something and just mull over that for a little while. Let's have a look and go, I'm not dead yet. It hasn't taken away my birthday. I haven't suddenly, you know, I'm not suddenly at the pearly gates meeting the maker, but maybe it's safe to take another piece. But just if we allow ourselves not to initially respond and buck back straight away, that just seems to be so difficult. Do you find in your experience that people are getting any better or worse over time with that idea?
That's a really good question. I think that we are more aware than we were a decade ago, 2 decades ago. I also think we're more informed, and I think there are a lot of things that we can mask our behavior with and through. And I also think that it's individual to people. So it takes a lot for someone to be able to say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, or thank you for that feedback. I wasn't aware of that, and I'm sorry that it made you feel that way, or whatever it is. So there's this pride element. And I think it's really about finding that neutral point around, I have confidence in my own abilities, but I'm also open to hearing other people's feedback. Because I think sometimes we can be too open to feedback, and we can be taking on everything. Whereas when we find the neutral point, we can accept the feedback, we can run it through a filter, which is this feedback meaningful for me right now? Yeah. can I do something with it? Or is this something, or is this more just, this is what they've seen. It doesn't represent everything. It's complex. It's really complex.
I wonder how it aligns with, you know, how occasionally you'll hear someone talk about gossip. If somebody comes up and wants to gossip with you, and then I'm hopeless with gossip because I can't remember gossip about other people and secrets and things like that. So somebody will gossip and really honestly, it's in there and out there and I've forgotten. So somebody will come up and say, remember what I told you about? I'm like, oh, no, I don't remember that because I just don't retain it. But anyway, that the rule around gossip is it important to me that you're telling me this? Is it important to that person that you're talking about? Have you got their permission to talk about them? Is what you're saying factually true and investigated? And, you know, can it be done in another way other than gossip? And so if we start operating on those principles, surely my feedback that I would ask, please make it factual, you know, not just, well, I think, you know, you rubbed me up the wrong way. It's not fact-based. It's very sort of experiential and emotional. Try and make it, as you said earlier, the observables. Is it good for us to be talking like this? Is it going to help me? Or are you just going to say, like you said, somebody says something about the color of your hair. Well, you know, I'm pretty gray. I don't know if you noticed, but if somebody says, I don't like the fact that you're gray, well, you know, what are we going to do? I immediately run out and get the Grecian, you know, I'm not sure that I... So it's not going to be useful to me. And if it's not useful to me, why tell me? And so I reckon there's some of those little magic elements in the law around gossip that probably are the laws that are around feedback as well.
I hate gossip and I don't even think there should be rules around it. I just think people should not do it like ever.
The rule is don't.
Just don't. Just stop it. If we can remove the word. What I don't understand is that, you know, we no longer send telegrams. We rarely use fax machines. So why are we using gossip to spread news? Because, you know, I was reading a book recently called Sapiens. I forget who the author is, but, you know, he talks about gossip being that's how we found out about news. And this was thousands of years ago, right? So I'm like, it served its purpose for the period that it was in, but we've moved well past that. So stop using it. I think we've repurposed it. I think a lot of the time gossip is used now to remain connected with people. And I think that people who do gossip for the purpose of connection and feeling close to people is that they don't have an alternative. They're not really sure if I'm not gossiping about someone, then what are we going to talk about? Does that mean I actually have to talk about myself? Because, well, that would be really scary. Or does that mean I have to actually hear about you? Because maybe I'm not interested. And so I really question, like, what are the quality of the relationships of people who use gossip as a form of connection?
Yeah, and I've got the book Sapiens. So Yuval Noah Harari is the author, and I can highly recommend Homo Deus as his next book. Really great. He talks about man in the future. So, you know, what's got us to where we are and what's likely going to shoot us into the future. And it's a great book, and they're both wonderful books. And he's an extraordinary thinker. With gossip as well, I think you're right. And I like, there's a saying that I think was attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt, but it's about the small mind talks about people and the medium-sized mind talks about things, but the large mind talks about ideas, concepts.
And possibility.
And possibilities. And so, and I really like that as a quote, which is, possibly I like it so much because I naturally can't talk about people. I'm so disinterested in gossip and so it appeals to my own ego to think that at least I'm not the smallest of the minds. But I'm using it. You see, I use it for my own good. It's like a tool to build myself up now. So thank you, Eleanor Roosevelt. I appreciate that very much. But I think that you're right about gossip. It served a purpose back when there really was no social media, no way of connecting to large groups at once and making a message. And as you said, and best of luck, you know, if you're talking about being a global speaker, because I think that's amazing, and I hope you get there. But the fact that there are things like TED Talks and all of that sort of stuff, yeah, it means that we're, and I have they, and it means that we don't need to gossip. There's plenty to talk about, plenty of concepts and theories and life enriching notions to talk about without having to talk about what old Mrs. Such and Such did or whoever did what with whoever's boyfriend, you know? And so yeah, I think you're right on the money. Just don't gossip, you know?
Yeah. And so the next time you have a conversation, rather than saying, "Oh my gosh, did you hear about?" say, "Oh my gosh, imagine if."
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that's a great way of starting a conversation, is thinking, getting people to think about concepts and possibilities. That, you know, the more we spread those ideas, the more things can be built for a better future, because obviously they've got to generate from somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's a casual way of brainstorming, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's fun. Well, I think it's fun.
Yeah, I do. Oh, yeah. So I tend to be known as a bit of a random thinker, that I'm quite often coming up with that sort of, oh, what if this was to unfold? And I wonder if, you know, so, but I have fun anyway. That's what matters to me.
That's what matters.
So if we had to say to people, all right, there are steps to take to become a good leader and models to follow, would you recommend that they, as you said, they go into an apprenticeship, do they then look for a coach and a mentor such as yourself, and then do they follow certain steps in terms of the chronology of their leadership?
Yeah, look, obviously, first of all, I would say get a copy of The Dynamic Leader, because it's got the pathway where I actually talk about the three pillars around, you know, you've got to invest in relationships. You've got to find who your authentic self is and start to communicate in an authentic way. You've got to operate with integrity, and you've got to be able to show vulnerability, which is what delivers you trust. Then you focus on inspiring respect, which is the next component. That is, how do I start to take on different perspectives and become curious about what other people say, and then adapt my style to suit? So you sort of move from relationships into respect. And the final one is about influencing results. And that's where you start to go, well, how can I empower the people around me and build the capability? But also what goes hand in hand with that is, how do I hold people accountable and myself accountable for what I'm doing? And then how do I remain transparent throughout the journey in order to deliver the results that we need to deliver? So that's kind of the stages that I would recommend people follow. And that's what I talk about in the book. And that's what I share when I'm running my Dynamic Leaders tutelage. It's really tool-based. It's very practical. It's simple. But if people stick to it, they'll end up just broadening their horizons. I would say if you can't afford a coach, then get a mentor. But 100% a coach is the way that I would go. I watched my older sister. She was, you know, engaging with coaches back in 1999, and she was doing it over the phone. I thought she was crazy because I was 19 at the time, and I was like, why on earth are you wasting your money on that kind of stuff? But I've seen it just completely project her future, and she's amazing at what she does now. And so watching what a coach has done to her over three decades has been so interesting. And so I absolutely get a coach if you can. Make sure it's a good coach. Make sure it's someone who is accredited. If you're not sure about accredited coaches go on to ICF, so the International Coaching Federation. You'll see a list of accredited coaches there. And so make sure you get a good coach, because I think ICF is really good for making sure that coaches do abide by, you know, certain ethical practice and are not, there's nothing wrong with how they're going about things, for want of a better word. So get the right coach.
Yeah, I like that. And so is it icf.com or .com.au or International Coaching Federation.com?
Oh, look, if you just search International Coaching Federation or ICF, it'll come up with whatever that is. I can't remember whether it's .org or .com, but yeah. Okay. It's they're very well known, and, you know, a lot of corporate organisations won't actually go near coaches that don't have ICF accreditation, just because it's like having a licence, essentially. They do audits and that kind of thing, so they're quite diligent.
Yeah. Great. Well, that's obviously a great place to start for those people that want to, after they've bought your book and are in touch with you about getting you over to their organisation and running some training and coaching and doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
So to finish off, Shelley, just conscious of your time here, how do people find you, and what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Oh, look, I like to be easy to get in contact with. So I'm very active on LinkedIn. If you just search my name or shelleyflett.com, it's a fairly easy website. I'm active on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. So, yeah.
The name and spelling. There we go. Make sure you spell it right, folks.
Yeah, I've even got a Twitch profile. So if you're looking for me on Twitch, it's Shelley_loves_ChicoRolls.
Righto then. That's good to know, Shelley. Good to know.
I try to be available on most platforms. So yeah, that's what you
want. Who doesn't love a good Chico roll? Let's face it.
I think it's un-Australian not to like a good Chico roll.
Exactly right. You like a chick. I'm sure it's on the immigration test, you know, Chico roll. Yeah, no, this guy said no. Out, son.
Hey, look, I'll share something with you. I went to the supermarket last week. I was staying with my parents and I bought a box of Chico rolls because it was Friday night. So it was fish and chip night. So we were cooking our own. And my mum dishes up these Chico rolls, and I took one look at it, and I was like, "That's not a Chico roll." And so I'm a little bit disappointed with Chico, who have Chico Corn Jacks in exactly the same packaging as Chico rolls. You ruined my Friday night. I missed out on my Chico roll.
That's it. Letter of complaint is being drafted at this moment.
There's not much wrong with the Corn Jack, unless you really wanted a Chico.
Well, and this is the point, isn't it? It's only really expectation being met.
Correct.
All right. Well, Shelley, you know what? It's a wonderful book, and congratulations again. I hear you're doing really well. And I really like the direction you take leadership. It's modern and motivating and inspiring. And I've got to tell you, I now look forward to the third book on feedback. And I think that'll be equally as inspiring and modern. So congratulations on your journey so far. And I really appreciate your time. And maybe you'll join me again on the podcast once the new book comes out.
Thanks so much, Tony. I'd love to.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. See ya.
Take care. Bye.